David Bohm Seminar Series 1, November 8, 1987, 11:30 morning session, Oak Grove School, Ojai, California.
Well, I begin that if anybody wants to raise any questions on this notion of values, you know, then.
Besides, the point we got where there seems to be false values or real values, do you think we're beginning to see maybe there's something more important than even value from value?
Well, perhaps there is something more important because, I think we have to ask, what is it that determines a value? You see, you always think of the value of something. So that which is valued must be more important than the value, right? Is that clear what I mean?
Yes.
But what is it?
But also, I'm beginning to question determination. What prejudiced determination must bring about false values?
Yes, that's the question we were raising. What brings about false values, you see? Right. You know, I hope that we're going to get into that very shortly. But before that, maybe if, you know, I'd like to see how people are thinking about this or considering it, if anybody wants to raise any other points.
Value part of a basis for our ability to operate in time?
Well, in any operation at all, you know, it depends on value, right? But, see, value is inseparable from meaning, right? And you can't, you know, meaning determines everything. Huh? Now, to change the meaning is to change the value, and that's to change your whole life, right? You see, if life means what it means to people today, then inevitably with those values, then you will live that way, right? Going through a period when we lose all that meaning may be important for changing the meaning. You see, it may not be possible to change the meaning without but the fear of that may block us.
Our values change over the years. When we're young, we're more concerned with having fun is of high value to us. As we get older, security and money
change. Yes, values change.
The priority of our values.
Yes, they're always changing, right? And also according to the place we live and so on, you know, the context of the people that surround us. We tend to adopt the values of the society we're in or the group we're in.
Consider love and compassion, what value has it?
Well, you know, that's in one sense a very high value, but at the same time, you know, one of the dangers is to try to, you know, to, if you give high value, to try to achieve it, right?
The search for achievement.
Yeah. You see, in our society, success has a very high value, right? And failure, a very low value. But success in a certain sense, right? But say somebody who doesn't succeed is called a loser, you see. You can question those values. You see, one of the points is to become aware of these values, to see what they are and to see what's in them, right? To see if they make sense.
It seems to me that when one senses and feels the love and compassion, the ego doesn't seem to be absent, at least in the reception of it. And when you give it, usually, if it has no motive, it appears to have high value.
Yes. Well, it depends on what you mean by the word motive. You see, that is, with every purpose, see, every value may generate a purpose, right? Which is can be called a motive. Huh? But not all purpose is, unfortunately, we tend to use motive, or fortunately or unfortunately, we tend to use motive in a very disparaging way, right? That's the way the meaning of the word has gone, like the motive for the crime. Now, motive is what moves you, you see, but the word has gotten a very special meaning, you know, which is limited. But you cannot say everything that moves you is wrong. It's a false value. You see, there may be something that moves you which has a true value. But it's a value that moves you.
It's a value that moves you?
Yeah.
Not the love and compassion?
Yes, that will move you too, but there's a value which is in it, right?
I didn't know it had value.
No, not that it had value, but you see, if you're going to do anything, there must be some value, you see. See, whatever you do depends on the value which you feel to be in it.
You know. The I is acting, is what you're saying.
Well, even not, you see, if you're going to do anything with a purpose, then there must be some sense of value in it, right?
What you do it without a purpose. All right. Which sometimes happens.
You may, yes, but you see, is there some sense of meaning behind it, nevertheless? You know, doesn't it mean something?
A reward or to get something?
Well, that would be one meaning, but
is value always a mental process?
Well, not necessarily. So you're trying to get to the sense if you have a true value. You see, for example, truth may be considered to be a true value, right? Now, it's not a motive.
That's what I thought love was.
Yeah,
how you value truth is, it becomes a motive.
What?
But how you value truth. Truth itself is not, but how you value it, in other words.
Well, you may be give it a false value, you see, but
yeah.
Truth itself is a value in the sense that we naturally give high value to truth, and in fact, we should give it a supreme value if it were properly done. That is, now, you see, truth, love, and intelligence cannot be separated. You see, if you say there's love, but it's not true, then that's has no meaning. Or if you say it's unintelligent, it also has no meaning, right? And to say love directed unintelligently would, you know, do harm, right? But its aim is not to do harm at all, right? Now, therefore, all these things, you see, they're all so closely interpenetrating that we can't analyze it. That there's something which we could call true value, or which involves all of that, right? See, if you had truth without love, it would be false, right? Well, try to work it out, I mean. What would be the point of it? I mean, suppose somebody's, you see, it depends on what you think, you see, but what would be an example of it? I mean, how would it be possible?
Truth without love?
Yeah. I mean, not merely correctness. Let me make a distinction of what is correct and what is true, right? A statement may be correct or incorrect, factual or not, but truth, I say, has to do with something much deeper, which includes this straightness, honesty of intention and so on, as well as faithful to that which is a true, correct perception, right? And it involves the whole of your being, therefore. Now, somebody could make a correct statement, this is a flower, but we wouldn't call that truth, right? In this way. And in fact, part of his deception might be to use that correct statement in the interest of a wider deception, right? Saying, that I happen to use this correct statement as part of the process in which I want to deceive you, right? So, therefore, truth is not the same as correctness. Now, if we take truth in that sense, could you say that there would be somebody who would be full of love and yet not straight?
We have one in television right now.
Well, I mean, but you being in the question, is it love, right?
So we're making a distinction between like when you say, what's truth without love, is like saying water boils at 212 degrees.
Yeah.
But that is not the kind of truth.
Yeah, that's correct. I call that a correct statement.
So that's
right?
A correct statement. Okay, so that's nothing.
Yeah, to do. Somebody who is out to deceive you could easily use that statement as part of his deception, right?
So we're back into that mental construct when we're talking about truth.
Well, truth is this question of being straight, honest, and faithful to that which is, right? And to have a true, correct perception, right?
So it makes truth a very large thing.
Yeah. And we say, first of all, love without truth is inconceivable.
But correctness without love is
inconceivable. It's obviously possible. Now, and truth without love, we would say, what would be the moving force behind to have truth if there were no love, right?
They're probably the same thing.
Yeah, well, at least that's two ways of talking of one whole, right? Beauty also is in there, you see. And goodness, all those things, you see. That, you see, they're all inseparable, right? They're ways, words that cannot really be given a definite denotation. What?
Hmm? Their point to the word.
Their point, but they don't have a definite denotation, right? Saying this is it, right? Hmm?
So there's a vast amount of things that are called truth that are really have nothing like
that. Yeah, and in fact, you see, the misuse of the notion of truth is one of the basic parts of deception, right?
And the notion of truth is one of those roots that I was asking about where it comes from. There seems to be an inherent notion that there's such a thing as truth in human
Yeah. Yes, and you see, our society is now very cynical and doesn't want to believe that there is. You see that people, there is such thing as truth, love, honesty, faithfulness, or goodness, or all those things. In the past, people at least professed those things, although they were seldom realized. But now people don't even want to profess them. You see.
Well, that looks fearsome. It may be the first step.
It may be an important step. Yeah.
Because to think I have truth and then I'm acting on it makes me very difficult to change. But to say there is no truth. It may not be true, but it might be closer because all the truths I was holding going.
Yeah, but it's also false in another sense. You see, that, see, if somebody is very cynical and says, you know, he is implying that his cynicism is beyond cynicism, right? Do you see what I mean?
Well,
that his motives for being cynical are not, should not be, are not themselves cynical, right? They're not subject to my cynicism. That you cannot be cynical about his motive for being cynical, right? But in fact, it's very easy to be cynical about somebody's motive for being cynical. You know, he has a motive which is just the same as those he's criticizing, right? You see, so therefore cynicism collapses because if cynic says everybody does everything for a motive, you know, he's got his axe to grind. But then what axe is the cynic grinding, you see? You see, it's implied he too is subject to the same conclusion.
I don't think anyone has mentioned the values that come right from the organism, the needs for warmth if you're cold.
Oh, yeah. Well, there are values, there are needs and so on, you see, which are there, right? Hunger and
those we'll never touch.
No, we're not concerned with them, but they cannot be supreme values. You see, if you put that as the supreme value, you're then going to get into the psychological domain. See, so if you put food as the supreme value, then you're going to interfere with your organism, right? And any of those things cannot be supreme values. They have to have limited value in the light of other values that are, you know, greater.
With the exception of survival.
Or even survival, people cannot put a supreme value. They have often said, I'm not going to survive in the interest of something else, right? They don't always put it as supreme value. And if you put it absolutely as supreme value above truth and so on, there would be no meaning to surviving, right?
Truth is not really a concrete thing, it's sort of a nebulous, I mean, because the concrete is the absolute value is blood or food or air. Well, to the organism that may be so, but we're saying that we've moved beyond this organismic into this realm of, like, you know, what Christ said, there's no greater love of any man than lay down his life for a friend. So he was saying that there obviously is greater value than life and as love, and love is, it seems to move into a whole different realm when we talk about love and compassion and truth, of which we seem to have the body in one hand and thought on the other, and someplace else is this other stuff that may really be what we're heading toward.
Yes. There are some values we're pointing toward which are of that nature, right? Going beyond even the physical needs and beyond the need for continuing life and so on. Now, although when we think of the whole of humanity, of the whole human race and so on, you could raise the question, you know, if the human race doesn't survive, what is the value of all the rest of it? You see, that's a very deep and difficult question. Right? That therefore it becomes very, very urgent to somehow get at this question of survival of the race, right? Though it may be that other races would come along, you know, you could take a bigger view, if you like, and say nature is probably experimenting with different kinds of creatures. You know, there was a program once showing somebody, the dinosaurs were extinguished about 75 million years ago for some reason that isn't very clear. And so they found the skeleton of a dinosaur that was about the human size and had a rather large head, and it had three opposable claws. And they thought this could be the beginning of an intelligent creature, right? by further evolution. So they showed how it might have evolved gradually, bit by bit, and began to look more and more like a human being. But it was still a reptile. So the point is that this possibility was lost by some accident. coming from outside, you know. But the human race may be lost as a possibility because of some internal accident, right? Going on with thought. But then people could speculate maybe in another X million years something else will turn up, or else on another planet or somewhere, you see. But on the other hand, you know, at least as far as we are concerned, you see, that really doesn't help us. You see, that if we hope to participate in this process, then we have got to deal with it, right? Otherwise, you know, we won't we'll go, right? And you could raise the question. What?
We are an endangered species.
Yeah, but we're endangering all the other species at the same time, you see. And there may be other planets and so on, probably are, but at least what's here is endangered, right?
Well, so at some point, man must have, at some ancient time, man must have reached a point where he could not find meaning sufficient to that he valued, and therefore created the notion of a heaven beyond this life.
Yes, well, obviously life became rather miserable under certain, you know, as civilization developed, and people then imagined a better life, you know, afterwards, and
so on. The meaning of this was sometime beyond.
Yeah, yes, and in fact, you see, even if it comes to the Christian religion, the original idea was the kingdom of heaven was going to be here, mm-hmm. just a matter of being brought about rather shortly. Mm-hmm. And then when it didn't come, obviously they wouldn't have even thought about it unless they'd been pretty miserable. Mm-hmm. And when it didn't come, they were left with their misery, and then they had to invent the idea, well, it's not going to be here, it's going to be up there. And and that way they could have a fantasy which would alleviate the misery, right?
And control the people.
Well, so other people, but you couldn't have that control unless there were the first value, the appeal that misery is alleviated, right? Mm-hmm. Mm. So we shouldn't primarily focus on the exploiters, but primarily on why people want to be exploited. Mm-hmm. Mm.
Could the up there possibly be here and now?
Yes, well, that was the original meaning of this religion, that it was either the kingdom of heaven is within, it is here and now, or since it doesn't seem to be here, it will be here shortly. And then when it didn't come, it's got to go up there, right?
I'm thinking of this beyond thought.
Yeah, well, that's right, but that may be what was the idea then, too.
Mm-hmm. So it's a web again.
Yeah. That was probably, if the ordinary way of thinking stopped, you see, and become as little children and so on, maybe that would be the kingdom of heaven. You see, people have probably had this intuition and from time to time over the whole of history or beyond, right? And people have had misery, which pushed them into it, right? That, you see, civilization never produced happiness, you see, or seldom, if ever, right? You know, if you go back to the Stone Age, well, life was simpler, at least, you see. There were 20 to 40 people who knew each other. They could sit in a circle and talk, and, you know, it was fairly easygoing. They were fairly free. I knew an anthropologist who said that he worked among the North American Indians, and he said, you know, you could think almost anything you liked, and nobody cared as long as you didn't make a nuisance of yourself. But say, as civilization developed, it became necessary to force people to think in certain ways because they were afraid society would be threatened if you thought in another way. Right? Hmm. So there was not a great deal of war because the weapons were very limited. And in fact, among the hunter-gatherer groups, people shared the hunt, they shared all the results of the hunt. And so on. You see, all the problems came later when you went to agriculture. You see, now people are wondering why human beings ever went from hunter-gatherer to agriculture. You see, there's some evidence they may have known about how to plant plants for quite a long time but didn't want to do it very much. And it's clear why not, because if you can get your food by hunting and gathering, it's much more interesting than to this back-breaking work of planting and plowing and, you know, work for 6 months, and then maybe it'll all be destroyed by insects or flood or whatever. loafers or whatever. See, no intelligent person would, at that point, would have chosen agriculture. But then they say there perhaps was a food shortage, and they said, well, unfortunately, we've got to plant plants, right? But then they got so much food that the population went up, and they got so high that it was no longer possible to live by hunting and gathering. Therefore, we are stuck with it, right? We have to go on with our agriculture, make it bigger and bigger. We've got to develop more and more technology, and so on, right? And you see, probably people used to get enough for their needs with 10 or 20 hours, 15 hours a week of work or hunting or whatever, but now that became necessary for much more, right? You see, and in fact, we still are not down to where it was then, you see, with all our machinery. And and at the same time, weapons were developed. Once metals were developed, you see, weapons became dangerous. The wars were perhaps a kind of sport until then. And then they became really dangerous and destructive, and you know, and also you could then take slaves, and it was pointed out, as I said, by D. Gordon Chow, that after that the development of technology almost stopped, because it was much easier to get wealth by plundering and taking slaves, you see. And then the only thing that was developed over several thousand years was iron, obviously, because it made better weapons, right? And other aspects of technology developed by accident, you see, that are very little. And you see, the very big cities and countries developed where you had to have tremendous authority, you had to have police to force people to obey the authority, you had to have armies to protect it. You know, you had other armies fighting, and you had to go into a whole business, and it got more and more miserable. You see that as the Roman, every one of these civilizations decayed, you see, from within, right? Like the Greeks, the Romans, and so on. It really is not clear that this whole thing has produced any greater happiness, right?
No, but through it all we can see how the changing values, can't we? The value of acquisitiveness,
yeah,
in the food field and so on.
Yeah, you had to have more acquisitiveness once you had agriculture, mm-hmm. You see, and you had to acquire wealth and minerals and weapons and, you know, gold and...
Thing that developed at the same time, and that was art and music.
Yeah.
We wouldn't have had any of this.
Well, there was already art and music among the most primitive people. You see, the 40,000 years ago, there was art on the caves, which is not bad, and to put it mildly. And also, even the Bushmen, you know, they do art. They do it with either paints that wear off, or in Australia, they do it in the sand, as they don't accumulate it, right? Yeah.
The Pueblo around Chaco, they were
There were North American Indians in the hunter-gatherer stage, and there were these others who were in the agriculture stage. But if you go down further south, you get the Aztecs and people like that, who were really had some very nasty customs. And they were very military and conquered, and they took their prisoners and massacred them on large scale as sacrifices and so on. They did a lot of unpleasant things. And you see, I don't think the white man has the unique credit for being nasty. Well, they weren't as bad, but I'm sure they had some, you know, that the Aztecs didn't just invent it out of nothing, you see. They just developed it further, you know. That even the, you know, the, who were the Indians in South America, the in the Andes? The Incas. Well, they had a priesthood, you know, running it. Now, there were some very nice things about it, but then probably there were other things that weren't so good, and you know, it must have had problems, you see, to run a state which was so large. Mm-hmm. They had to have some kind of authority which was arbitrary, and they had to have fear. You see, once you get to a group of about over 40, you're going to have hierarchy and authority and things like that. I think it's a general tendency, yeah.
But on the other hand, the Mayas also had their types of seminars and rituals, and they used to gather to study the stars, and they had sessions and discussions, and there's one book, the Popo Vuh, where they really questioned, how would I put it, the beyond thought movements of man.
Now, I think in this whole process, there were always people who could see that this was not enough, you know. The ordinary person would say, okay, that's the way life is, right?
But the popular values were something beyond that.
That's right. You see, this one of these anthropologists who studied the North American Indians, he said that you have about 10% of the people who are either philosophically inclined or, you know, they're maybe shamans or, you know, they have various interests beyond the ordinary. And then 90% are the ordinary people who just are busy with everyday life. They pay no attention to the remaining 10% until some trouble occurs, and then they go to those 10% to get help. And then when the emergency is over, they forget about it, you see. And we said that the percentage is much the same in our own society. That's the way it goes, that 90% of the people are very oriented toward the problems of everyday life and saying, you know, that concerns us, that fills our minds, right? Now then 10% somehow are not satisfied with that and begin to look in other directions.
Can the people destroy the earth? And therefore, if you took a big view, even though we do exist, would you say, was there a reason for man, considering the wrong turn you took right from the beginning, and this rather sordid summing up of the long line, was it a good thing that man came along?
I can't say at the moment. You see, I hope that it's not the end, you see.
You talk about a thousand years.
Yeah, but I'm saying I hope something is going to happen to change all this, you see. But we have to point out the danger, but we also have to point out the potential, right? You see, I think we should move gradually toward that direction. Mm-hmm. You see, that in spite of all that has gone wrong, there is a tremendous potential in humankind, right?
Sort of where we are, we can learn how through history we've come to this point, but I don't think we can learn how through history to get out of it.
Yeah.
Because not only are we faced with the ultimate danger of our weapons, but we're also faced with the ultimate possibility of not having to slave anybody because of a technology, mm-hmm. right? This balancing point.
Yes, that's a key point that, you see, if you go back to the ancient Greeks, they justified slavery. By saying you would never have any culture at all without slavery. Everybody would just have to do backbreaking work most of the day. And where would you be, you see? Now, there's no art, no science, no philosophy, you know, no this or that, right? And then I think, well, it may have been Aristotle, if I can remember correctly, who said that if there was something, these tasks would just do themselves, we wouldn't need slaves, you see? But you see, it turned out that that's what we're developing, these machines, right? And you see, also the Greeks even knew about machinery. They invented a small steam engine, as you know, worked by reactive jets. But they regarded it as a toy. And you see, one of the objections to it was this, that it was not only not necessary, but what would the slaves do if you had these machines? So that shows the way our values get turned around, right? That originally the slaves were put there to, you know, do things because we didn't want to be occupied all the time. And then later it became a value. Just continuing the present setup becomes one of the values, right? Saying we cannot risk upsetting the present structure, and therefore if the slaves have got to be occupied, you see. It goes around like that. You can see it. See, we take a broad view of history, a long view of history, and say this is not a new problem. The human race has been in it, and the tendency is there in the animal toward violence, right? That in the chimpanzee, and that is violence which is mixed with thought, right? Which is based, maintained by thought, and by thinking of how evil or bad the other side is, or something like that, or how good it would be to take away the things he's got and have them for yourself and so on, right? And it seems that there is something in this, in our whole evolution, that has this potential for destructiveness and violence and deception in it, right? There are other intelligent creatures on the earth besides the one on our own line, and for example, there are the dolphins and whales who are not, they don't have the opposable thumb and finger, and therefore they could not develop tools, but they seem to be quite intelligent otherwise. And if the question is whether, intelligence may not even require that we have this hand that does things, right? But we have developed it through that, right? And that has gone into technology and so on. Now, and a lot of our values are connected with that line of development. Now, let's suppose we begin to look at another question. I don't know if there's time now. It's 12:05. I wanted to raise the question about values again. You see, what sustains them? You see, the false values, right?
He was saying at the beginning that what we value is not the value itself, but what is value?
Yes, but we also value the values.
That is not the important element. The value itself is something underlying it.
Yeah, well, that really is the usual case, isn't it? You know, you may say you value money, but that's one of our big values in society today, but money is for what it can buy, right? But at a certain stage, money becomes a value in itself. When you have enough, it begins to give you a feeling, which is good, and then that makes you value money just for the sake of money, right?
So then it's the feeling
that... Mm-hmm. You see, values are power, they're strength, right? A value liberates strength in you, it liberates energy, right? Now, the kind of energy that it liberates may itself be sensed as valuable, right? And also the lack of that energy is sensed as no value, right? Or a negative value, right? So therefore, we begin to value our values, and that makes it hard to change the value. You see, suppose I begin valuing money because I need it, right? To buy food and so on. I get more and more money, and I get used to certain comforts, and I value it because I need those comforts, right? Then I get still more money, more than I can possibly spend, but I still value it, because now it gives me a sense of power and strength, and when I think of all that money, it feels good inside, right? If I think of losing it, it feels very bad. See, if the stock market is high, I say, look, I have $100 million, it feels good. Now the stock market has dropped, and I've lost a third of it, see? It's almost like losing a third of myself. Because that feeling of strength and power, that sense of being me, being something which is powerful and strong and good, comes from possessing that and thinking I possess that money, right? But it needn't be money, obviously. I may possess a jewel of great beauty, you see, saying this has tremendous value. By contemplating that jewel, I get some special feeling, right? Or something else, you see, whatever it is, something of beauty, of power, of exceptional quality. I may say my ability to do certain things is what gives me a sense of value, whatever it be, whether it be sports or intellectual or whatever, right? And therefore, without that, I feel that I have no value. And when you say I feel it's nothing, I feel there's nothing of value there, right? Because obviously something is there. Therefore, we begin, that leads us to value values, right? And that sort of gets into a slippery slope, right?
Where self-deception comes in?
That's part of self-deception. You see, if you value the value, then you cannot change the value. You must deceive. You see, suppose you value, there's a sense of value in belonging to the community and, you know, thinking we're doing something great and so on. So that feels good. And then we value that value. Now, suppose somebody comes along and says, you know, this community is pretty corrupt and it's pretty silly what they're doing and so on. You lose something inside, right? Therefore, you say, I can't admit that. You must be mistaken. I deny what you say and I affirm the opposite. I get back, apparently, my sense of being, right?
When you do lose a value, you actually feel inside that something is gone. I mean, you have a relationship with someone that you value, and when that relationship breaks down, you have a great empty, worthless... Feeling. I mean, oftentimes a person feels quite worthless after something.
Yeah, but worth is value, right? Yeah, so you have lost your value, right?
Thing. You actually feel like you're worthless.
That's right. So you feel, but value is power. Therefore, you feel something really power, energy, value, you know, being has gone out of you, right?
Right. Hmm? Actual
being. And you see the word worship has the root worthy. It means to give supreme value, right? To worship God is to have God as supreme value. Then you feel you've got something in you, right? You see, if you have such a supreme value, you see, whatever you worship has supreme value. It is said that many people worship money, right? That means they give it supreme value, right? Hmm? Some people worship power. Therefore, they have to give that supreme value. The power outside creates that sense of strength and power inside. And therefore, I feel I am something, right? I have being, right?
So you are your values.
I am my values, that's right. And therefore, my value is my being, is another way of putting it, right?
Some way the values make up the mud.
The what?
The mud that you were describing.
If they're false values, they're going to make up mud, right? If they're true values, they're going to help, you see. But so if my values affect how I see, right? We've just seen that. If I value, my country and my society, and I feel good inside, then if somebody comes along and wants to expose it, I feel bad inside. Therefore, I don't want to accept the exposure, right? So that's the mud.
I feel that this session and this seminar has very deep value.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel also that there's love and compassion here. And I feel also that it's like a family where I can have open inquiry.
Mm-hmm.
Now tear that apart. What's wrong there?
I didn't say anything is wrong. I'm glad that you feel that way and that...
One of the things that could be wrong is if that became so valuable that we stopped being able to move.
Yes, there may be still some false things here, you see, we've got to look at, right?
And also, looking at an outside source to solve the problem, if there is one.
What?
I said also looking for an outside source to comment and solve the problem. She said, now tear that apart.
Oh.
As if you're the one to tear it apart.
Mm. Well, I thought you'd come up with some assumption from physics.
No, you see, I'm saying that we are really looking at false values for the time being, and not for the sake of that, but rather because the true values might emerge. Right? Hmm. And the point is that true value means true meaning and true being. Right? Meaning and value are being. That is, you cannot say that I have certain meaning to life and besides that I'm something else. That is, what life means to you is what you are, right? Yeah, everything happens inside and outside will go according to that meaning.
Yeah, so what you're doing is what you are because what you're doing reflects your values.
Yeah. That's right. Your purpose is your value, and your purpose determines what you do, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that may be the question to come. But why is there more happiness or inner content if I think we are what we are? There's no question about it. But we seem to be a most unhappy, discontented.
May we have a false value about what happiness really is.
Maybe.
An untrue meaning, which we place value on.
Like we have accumulation as a value, but maybe the real value is something else that accumulation is in contradiction with. And yet we've given value to accumulation, having lots of things. And that actually isn't true.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore the real value, quote real value, is being smothered, and therefore that is what unhappiness is. I mean, if you could have a whole society, I mean, what's war but giving value to something that creates nothing but misery? And to say, why can't we be happy while we have war, would be sort of a contradiction in terms. Well, maybe why can't we be happy while we're so acquisitive and so separative and so lonely? Those may be impossible. I mean, we're unhappy because we are unhappy. We're unhappy because of what we're doing. What we're doing is because of what we value, and what we value brings it up. Okay.
Seems sort of strange to have to live with a discontent, and maybe it's a divine discontent, I don't know.
Well, if one was discontented, maybe that would be divine discontent.
But to be unhappy is not necessarily discontent. Unhappy means you're just not getting what you want. Being discontented is to be open to some kind of deep
search. I think it's a better word than happy. I think it has to do with content.
Right, well, those are probably
peace of mind, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, well, the people, it will not possible to have peace of mind if your values are false and contradictory. Right. You see that you'll be driven in all sorts of directions, and inside and outside. And so I think we're approaching the end of this period. That what I suggest is that we can go a bit further into these, how these false values are sustained, especially. Two things I want to discuss in the afternoon, value judgments and the ego, you know, the self, the structure of the self-image as the source of false values, right? Or as the repository of them or whatever. And then if we get that, we go through that fairly carefully, then maybe we can begin to look, before this whole meeting ends, at what might be the true values, you see. At least begin to try to sort of discern their outlines or some vague sense of them anyway.